Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Seb Stafford-Blore from Tifo Football, and Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst. Sometimes, you know, we get it wrong. I think it's fair to say we all expected an all-Manchester FA Cup final. Instead, it's a London derby between Chelsea and Arsenal. Why? Let's look at two managers in the same city, but at different stages of their career. Questions can and should be asked about the selection and strategy of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. He's got a big decision coming up on David De Gea. But what about Pep Guardiola? It would be absurd to question his body of work as a coach. But Aid, should his record at Manchester City be coming under more rigorous scrutiny?
Oh, it's such a tough one because he is an exceptional coach. He really is. But he's not perfect. And it's a slightly checkered record, it's fair to say. Yeah, if people are claiming that he is the perfect coach and that he's flawless, then that's clearly not true. He's got blind spots, no doubt about it, in terms of the way that they set up defensively. I think that the fullbacks have been weak for a long, long time. It's something he hasn't addressed, the centre-backs too. And his record in European competition when coming up against the elite has exposed those deficiencies tactically. So yeah, he's made mistakes and isn't the second coming as a coach, but he's still truly exceptional in my opinion and someone to be admired.
What about, let's look at the specifics, Seb, if we could, and recruitment. You know, I did some sort of trawling around on Transfermarkt, looking at the fees that have been paid for players in the Guardiola era at City. Money has been paid for 31 players. Now, the 18 most expensive of those players cost £664 million. So you compare that to his time at Bayern, where I think he spent €204 million. At Barca, it was about €340 million. And you've got to ask, how many unqualified successes there? I suppose you can say Laporte, 56 and a half million, Edison, 36, Gabriel Jesus, 29. Apart from that, it doesn't really tell you that there's a very functional recruitment department at the City.
Yeah, and I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Mike. I mean, the comparison between City and Bayern Munich, well, actually, Bayern Munich, the recruitment was very good. I think a player like Thiago has been outstanding for Bayern for the last 6 or 7 years. But I have big questions about how City alight on certain players, particularly defensively. I mean, the fullbacks alone are very interesting. I mean, centre-backs, obviously, Stones is the headliner, Otamendi. I mean, I know he's been a first-teamer for a long time, but I'm not convinced that he's ever shown that he's a defender of the kind of the calibre that his fee suggested. Danilo was an extraordinary one because he was a player that never really seemed to fit the system because he arrived in the same year as Kyle Walker and he was, you know, always more comfortable on the right side of the defence. So, I mean, I've got a little bit of sympathy because if you're Manchester City and you're negotiating for a player, it's pretty difficult to find a strong negotiating position, isn't it? I mean, in the past, I think Ed Woodward has spoken at Manchester United about the kind of the tax that's applied on their transfer interest, and naturally that inflates fees. At the same time, however, I think in both cases, but obviously because we're speaking specifically about City, I think some of the players they chase are, these are confusing decisions. And also, you know, maybe there isn't quite enough scrutiny of that department, because whenever we talk about City's executive structure, all that ever gets said is, well, it's the imported Barcelona model. It's full of all of these employees that are associated with so much success in the past. And yet, is there the same kind of discussion about the actual dynamics, the micro dynamics, and the way that there is at, say, for instance, Arsenal? We know about the transfer committee at Arsenal. We don't know what it does, but we know of its existence. You know, and we, you know, similarly, we understand the dynamic at Liverpool with Michael Edwards and, you know, the relationship he has with Jurgen Klopp and the owners above him. At City, not quite the same. Who is the dominant voice in these conversations?
Yeah, look, I think it's easy to look back and say that the ex-player was a mistake and whatnot. But Kyle Walker, they signed him when he was on top of his game at Spurs. Benjamin Mendy, I would have signed him based on the performances that he was producing in the Champions League. So I think that those two players, I understand why they went for them. But yeah, you're right in terms of the structure. How does it work? What's the decision-making process? I do think a lot have worked. I mean, Leroy Sané hasn't got a mention. I think that he was a good pickup and they'll surely make a handy profit on him. I wouldn't write off Rodri either. I know that he costs an awful lot of money, but
he's
done some good things this year. Yeah, he's okay. A decent enough player.
Yeah.
But look, what do you get for 60 right. million, I suppose, these days? It's crazy, isn't it? Yeah, I think you could probably scrutinise most clubs and pick out winners and losers,
but not on this scale, surely. Aid, you know, £664 million is an awful lot of pennies, isn't it?
Yeah, but to them it's not that big a deal, is it? It's as simple as that. You pay what you can afford, and they felt that they could speculate almost £60 million on João Cancelo and stick him on the bench. He could be a backup, but they knew that. They didn't necessarily believe he would walk straight into the team ahead of Kyle Walker. They just live in a different world to the rest of us, Manchester City. So yeah, I think that's why they pay over the odds, because they can.
Yeah. So is it in that context, Seb? Is it fair that they should be judged by different standards, more exalted standards? Because look at the implications of potential defeat to Real Madrid in the Champions League tie, which is outstanding. If you look at City and think, right, okay, this should be a club that wins the Champions League, they're surely four players short of a Champions League winning team, aren't they?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think we've raised this several times before, is that I think probably I'd have at least three players within that defensive system need to change. But Mike, it's interesting, the exalted standards and the way they're criticised. I do think they should be held to that higher standard. And I think part of the reason why is because of the way that Guardiola behaves. Guardiola, for, you know, for anyone who's been in one of his press conferences, is extraordinarily sensitive. He's very prickly. He doesn't react well to anything other than pure, unfiltered praise. And I think this creates this situation where, okay, with reference to the Real Madrid game, to that tie, he's taking a lead into a second leg against a manager who is kind of, I mean, Zinedine Zidane is the most disrespected three-time winner of a European Cup in the history of sport. And yet, sort of, if you place Guardiola against someone like that and he loses, you're going to get criticism because of, A, all the things that are said about him, rightly. He's one of the most successful coaches of his generation, of any generation. But also the way he holds himself in the game and this kind of status that he has. It's natural. This is what's going to happen. This is life at the top of the game.
Yeah. On Guardiola quickly, no, but not Guardiola, the City, the club. One thing that they do that maybe others don't, like Manchester United, that they have a wage structure of sorts, don't they? They have walked away from quite a few deals in terms of not wanting to pay crazy money for certain individuals. So it's a strange one. They're happy to pay the big fees, but sometimes they will walk away from a deal they want to do if the player seeks crazy
sometimes
wages.
They've been really smart with that. I mean, walking away from Alexis Sanchez looks a really smart move.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, because that's one of the worst transfers in the history of the Premier League, that really. certainly one of the worst contracts. So they are capable of it. It's just that it's weird that that doesn't extend across the board, isn't it?
I'd be worried, by the way, if I was a Man City fan about this Real Madrid tie on the basis of the chances that they've been conceding of late. And I did a bit of digging in terms of stats with City. And this, again, points towards Guardiola and actually his in-game management. Okay, 11 times they've lost this season, City, in all competitions. In seven of them now, they've not just conceded the first goal, they've conceded the second goal as well. They've gone 2-0 down, which tells you that they don't react well to chasing games. And if you're being ultra critical, you have to look at the manager there and say, what is he doing to change things around, to change the pattern of matches, to get them back into games? From 1-0 down, I mean, 10 of the 11 defeats they've conceded first. They are not good chasers, and that doesn't reflect brilliantly on Pep.
Yeah, okay. So if we're going to question the sorcerer, let's also talk about the apprentice, Mikel Arteta. Seb, tactically, he seems unafraid to change his shape. If you look at the way that they've been playing, it sort of conforms to the way the game has been sort of strategized since the restart. You know, I saw a statistical summary where there's less pressing, more passes per shot, more emphasis on controlled possession, more lawn mowers.
Not again. I think let's just apologize to anyone listening. Carry on.
Right. Okay. So, Mikel Arteta as a tactician and as a leader, discuss.
Very impressed with him, Mike, on that sort of tactical strategic note. I thought the first goal they scored against Man City at the weekend, the first Aubameyang goal, all those passes, that working out from the back, I felt that was kind of the emblem of what football's looked like during this period. Forgive me, I've forgotten where I read it, but I read in a really interesting article about how maybe that goal doesn't get scored if there's a crowd in the stadium, just because if you're passing the ball out, before Arsenal took the lead in that game, they'd had a few ropey moments at the back with trying to work the ball up into midfield between Mustafi and Luis. There was a little bit of a miscommunication. I think Raheem Sterling might have scored in the first 10 minutes. You're seeing the protagonist Arsenal that Unai Emery promised. When he first came in and he said, oh, you know, we're going to be the protagonist. We're going to be the aggressors on the ball. And obviously that was a rope which was eventually used to hang him. Now with Arteta, that's actually the reality. Arsenal are bolder. Forgetting all the issues that still exist in their departments, they need a couple of players in defence, probably in midfield. These are problems we're aware of. The way they're playing is more modern. It's more in keeping with what we've seen from teams like Manchester City, from teams like Liverpool. You know, not in the same way. They're not doing it to the same standard. They are at least conforming to a kind of a more modern approach.
So, if we look at Arsenal, record 21st FA Cup final, we talked about recruitment in terms of Manchester City. What about Arsenal? Is it now time for the board to invest in Arteta's expertise and vision?
Well, I think so. I think that this was a landmark victory potentially in that sense. If there were people at the top of Arsenal's hierarchy that weren't sure whether they were willing to speculate, to accumulate, maybe they would have had their arms twisted by really professional win against Manchester City that did showcase Arteta's qualities as a coach. He's a very bright young manager. I like him as a disciplinarian. Seb's always already referenced it. You know, how he's dealing with Ozil and Guendouzi, I think, was a line in the sand. And wasn't that an incredibly disciplined performance? And it was a clever performance because it preyed on City's weaknesses. It was all about denying their forwards the space, so you know, getting players behind the ball, having this good structure and shape, but also when there was a chance to go and win it inside the final third, to turn the ball over in a great area, they were really aggressive in everything they did, and that stood out to me. But in terms of recruitment, yes, he needs better players to work with. Nothing has changed on that score. Yes, it's a brilliant result, but he needs better defensive players for sure. And also, crucially, to be able to keep the star men that he's already got in forward areas. You know, Aubameyang and Lacazette, again, it was another reminder of what they bring to the table. Lacazette won't score as many goals as Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, but he does a terrific job for the team. It might be that he sacrificed for a rebuild, but I would really regret seeing him or Aubameyang leave this summer because I think they've got plenty more to offer.
Yeah, if I were an Arsenal fan, I'd be a bit worried about, you know, what seem to be pretty well-sourced stories speculating about a potential swap, Coutinho for Guendouzi. You know, surely in that, the wages will be prohibitive, if nothing else. Is it better to basically cut cloth and say, OK, let's prioritise another loan for, you know, Danny Ceballos, for example? Where would you pitch it, Seb, that whole strategy of recruitment?
I think it's really important they prioritise where they're going to be in sort of 5 years' time. I saw the Coutinho story, Mike. I'm also aware of what Arsenal's wage spend is and the kind of money that it would cost to bring a Coutinho in at this stage of his career. Now, also, let's be aware of who Philip Coutinho's agent is, because Kia Drabchin has been the centre of a lot of news relating to Arsenal with new contracts and potential new players. And it's worth saying that no football club really was ever built around the kind of the interests of an agent or a representative, as Kia Drabchin prefers to be referred to. I want to see Arsenal looking at components, not stars of the game. I want to see them buy players or loan players who can gradually be worked into this team. So if Arsenal need a centre-half, they need a full-back, or they need a midfielder, the answer to them under Arteta isn't just to go out and buy someone who has an established reputation in the game. It's to buy a piece of soft clay, essentially, someone who can come in and gradually move up the pay scale, not exerting pressure on the club's financial structure, and become the kind of player that Mikel Arteta needs them to be. Because I think one of the things we've seen also is that one of the commodities that he prefers is submissiveness, almost. If you're not going to bow to his authority, which, let's be honest, someone like Philip Coutinho is not going to do, given where he's been in the game and given the things that he, given the teams that he's played in, do you think he's going to come in and bow to the authority of a manager who has less than a year's experience in the game? No. So you have to work around that scenario, and that's where Arsenal are really at the moment.
So in that context, Aid, more Kieran Tierney's?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there were some people singing the Kieran Tierney song, actually. You know, the old Ryan Giggs song, number one was Kieran Tierney, number two was Kieran Tierney. because he has the attitude that you want from all of your players. He's very switched on. He's aggressive, determined in everything that he does. And he just seems like a real old-fashioned team man, doesn't he? Clubman of the Year, Kieran Tierney. I don't think they give out the Clubman of the Year award anymore, do they? But he would probably win it every single time. I like him. I liked him at Celtic. I think he's a proper fullback who can also, as we've seen now, do a very, very good job as a left-sided central defender. I thought the way that he tucked in and played so narrowly against City really helped David Luiz put in such a great individual performance. I thought those two were exceptional. So yeah, look, I do agree with Seb. I think that the superstar names are not necessarily what Arsenal need. You can't be signing players just because you have good relationships with certain agents. You have to get the right types for the manager and for their philosophy. I'm excited about it. I really am, because I do feel that Arteta will improve players. But I just hope that he's given the funds, because without the funds, Arsenal will be able to produce these one-off excellent performances and beat anybody. But they will continue to flounder unless they bring in just more talented defensive players.
Mm. You mentioned in passing David Luiz there. I thought there was a really good interview with Des Kelly after the game where Luiz talked about, you know, football is about surviving. And you saw the human side of a seasoned footballer who, let's be honest, we gave terrible clog to about a couple of weeks ago. Is that the sort of performance, Seb, that emphasises the riddle about David Luiz? Because there is a very good player in there somewhere, but it doesn't turn up that often.
I think that's right, Mike. I think one of the things with Luis is when you watch him play, even when he's at his very, very worst, it's not a mystery why so many clubs have taken a risk on him and so many clubs have been willing to indulge his game for the good parts that still exist within it. But it's actually a lovely story. I, for all his flaws as a footballer, I really enjoy listening to David Luiz. He's a frank talker. He's very blunt. He's honest. The Des Kelly interview was wonderful because I think Des did very well, to be honest, because he sort of tiptoed around a sensitive issue. But it's very rare that you see a player take ownership of something like that and say, actually, let's be honest, it was criticism of me. You know, not of anyone around me, not of the goalkeeper, not of the defensive midfielders. It was aimed at me. I was the source of, you know, all the mockery. And it was just this wonderful human moment. And it reminded me a little bit of Per Mertesacker's cup final performance. Mertesacker obviously was an outstanding defender, and it was a very different scenario, but he was presumed to be well past his best. And I remember the days leading up to the cup final when it was obvious that he was going to play. He was mocked before he'd even stepped on the pitch. And it was very similar because they both gave outstanding performances in situations where you would expect anything but. So it was great. It was good for the game, actually, because I think sometimes these narratives about the sort of the comedic elements of a player's game. And we spoke about Phil Jones a few weeks ago, and it's exactly the same there, where someone becomes a figure of fun and everything they do is a meme and, you know, a laugh, cry emoji, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that kind of stuff. It's nice when a player breaks that cycle, and that's what Luis did over the weekend.
And football, as you know well, Aid, is all about season and opportunity when it arrives. Emi Martinez has done exceptionally well. Do you think Leno will get his place back?
It's a good question. It's not going to be a foregone conclusion that he'll get his place back, because Emi Martinez has been exceptional.
Oh, outstanding.
No question
outstanding.
About it. He's got an aura. He's physically, you know, he's a very big keeper. He's dominant with his decision making in the air. His long levers, those long arms of his, have saved at least a couple of goals in recent games. You can't drop him. Mikel Arteta won't drop him. No chance. Absolutely no chance Arteta leaves Martinez out of the side until he starts to make errors, in my opinion. Leno, it's very unfortunate on him because he was having a very, very good season and was undisputed number one. But you can't ignore what you're seeing with your own eyes. And Martinez, in the space of a few weeks, has transformed himself from little-known number two outside of Emirates Stadium into one of the Premier League's most exciting goalkeepers. He's not young. You've got to remember that. He's in his late 20s. He's had to wait a long, long time for this opportunity, and he has grabbed it, you're right. And look, if he does lose his place to Bernd Leno at some stage early on next season, then there'll be a queue around the block to sign him.
He catches everything,
proven,
doesn't he? Like that's what I really like about him. He reminds me a little bit of Bruce Grobbelaar. Not necessarily in style, but in the way that his aim always is to catch everything. That save he made from Riyad Mahrez, when Mahrez cut in across the box and then drove at his near post. A, the reach on his left hand to get to the ball, but also it's stuck. Because if that ball rebounds back into a dangerous area, that's a goal. It's just outstanding goalkeeping. I mean, I feel like sometimes goalkeepers are always prone to either being underrated or overrated, and their saves they make, you know, similarly so. And that's a really good example of people just seeing what looks like a bread and butter save and actually misread it. That's brilliant goalkeeping.
On that shot, by the way, it was the only shot on target, wasn't it, for Manchester City in the game. I asked our pals at Opta, when's the last time in a domestic match, domestic competition, that Manchester City had one shot on target or fewer? March 2017, Stoke
really?
City,
wow.
In the Premier League. Yeah, quite remarkable. So look, it's a feat of sorts. And I think that the protection he got, actually, Arsenal had a bit of luck with some wayward finishing, of course, from City. But the protection Martinez got in this game, not just from the back three, but from the whole 11, was a bit special, I think. And it's a performance that Arsenal fans are very proud of, and rightly so.
Okay, since we're talking about stats, here's one for you, Seb. I've stolen it from Rich Jolly, who comes up with some belters now.
Hey, man, Rich Jolly owns all the stats, though, doesn't he?
Right. Olivier Giroud could become the first player to win the FA Cup five times in seven seasons since Charles Wollaston, who, as every schoolboy knows, did that between 1872 and 1878. He is evergreen, isn't he, Mr. Giroud, or Monsieur Giroud?
I think he has attributes that don't really wear with time. I think if you look at what makes him a good player and what makes him a credible forward, even now, well into his 30s, those aren't attributes that kind of depend on athleticism or explosiveness. But also, guys, I mean, I think what's really important about someone like that is let's focus on his professionalism. Olivier Giroud until probably about 4 or 5 months ago, didn't have a future at Chelsea. If you look at the way he was treated in the first half of this season, I think that if it had been another manager, someone that the media didn't quite as like as much as we do in Frank Lampard, let's be fair, that would have received a little bit more criticism, because he was kind of annexed from the side for no good reason. And yet he came back in when the side needed him, when injuries made it a necessity, when it was revealed that really, when it was shown that Michy Batshuayi not really good enough to play at this level. And he's come in and he's been decisive again and again and again, not necessarily in his goals, but in the way that he's allowed some of the supporting players around him to perform. Look, for instance, at how well Mason Mount has played around him, how well Christian Pulisic has operated around him. You know, Giroud is great in a very literal way. He scores goals, he creates chances, but he's also a terrific facilitator. He's a very pliable player. He's someone that's able to adjust around the styles of different footballers who Chelsea also need to be playing well at the moment. And he deserves an awful lot of credit for that.
Mike, can I jump in and ask you a question for once?
Yeah, go for it.
Look, don't take this the wrong way. You've been around a while. You've seen a lot of players.
Where's this going?
Okay, you've watched a lot of football. Have you ever
seen... in the Charles Wollaston fan club.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I'm going with this. Have you ever seen a striker, a centre-forward, that attacks crosses at the near post better than Olivier Giroud? Because that goal that he scored, for me, was absolute trademark Giroud, nipping in front of his marker, steering it in at the near stick with his foot or his head, often his feet. I think he's the best in the business at it.
Mm. I suppose Van Nistelrooy used to do that quite a lot, didn't he? You know, I was struck by that goal as well. It was also the subtlety of it, you know, the subtlety of the touch. And again, I suppose that's what you pay for ultimately is experience. And, you know, I think, and Seb's right, that we are inclined to give some credit to Frank Lampard, one, because of his personality. But secondly, I thought the way that he has actually responded to Giroud is a sign of his managerial maturity, isn't it?
That's fair.
He's basically
That's
put fair. His hands up and said, look, actually, yeah. I probably got that wrong.
Yeah.
Go on.
He just hung his hat on Tammy Abraham, didn't he? He was determined to give him a shot. And not just a two games, let's see how you go shot. It's almost as if he promised Tammy an extended run in the side. I don't think he would have vocally promised Tammy that, but he wanted to give him that chance. And in the early parts of the season, he was brilliant. But ultimately, I think it's been proven that Giroud is the better all-round striker still. But yeah, he could have been stubborn there, but he's no fool, Frank Lampard. And if he can see every day the qualities that Giroud brings. So it was only a matter of time before he gave the big man another chance. And well done to Olivier for showing the right attitude.
Yeah.
Frank Lampard's talking about 3 cup finals left, the first at Liverpool on Wednesday. When you look at Chelsea, they seem to have stabilised in, you know, transitional circumstances. I think it's 9 wins out of 11, something like that. Do you expect Chelsea, Seb, to hang on to a top 4 place?
Oof, it's going to be close. I mean, from what I saw from Leicester on Sunday, yes, I'd say so. I mean, this seems a little bit sour on my part because of what we said about who we said the prospective finalists would be. I think Sunday's semi-finals a little bit more about Manchester United. I'm reticent to read too much into the way Chelsea played. As impressive as they were, I think they'll almost hold on to this spot by default. I don't think they'll beat Liverpool, but I think they will beat Wolves at Stamford Bridge on the last day of the season. As encouraged as I am by the players that are coming in, and there's rumours this morning that they're close to a deal for Kai Havertz from Leverkusen, and that he's a terrific player, I still have big issues with that defence. That needs huge investment, and I'm a little bit worried because unless Roman Abramovich is willing to bankroll another further £150 million after Havertz comes in, which is probably about 70 or 80 quid later, 80 million quid later, it's going to look very lopsided. And so how do you, as Frank Lampard, how do you give the right conditions to this new attacking unit to prosper? It's a little bit of a conundrum. I think they'll get through. I think they'll make the Champions League. I think what happens after that, I mean, maybe that is the question. Maybe they are waiting for that to be confirmed before completing the rebuild. But that rebuild does need to happen. You know, a Hakim Ziyech, a Timo Werner, Kai Havertz, these players, they make you a slightly different side, yes, but they don't disguise some of the flaws that this team obviously has all across the defence and the goalkeeper. That's a huge problem, which hasn't really been addressed. The goalkeeper's not good enough. The goalkeeper also, unfortunately for Chelsea, there is no landing spot in European football at the moment for someone who is going to cost what he does, even on loan, or who earns what he does. I mean, his reputation has been really badly damaged by his time in England. So there are issues at Chelsea. Hopefully Champions League football and Champions League revenue helps them to address it, but they do need to be processed properly.
Well, let's look at Man United then, Aid. Am I being fair? You know, I'm not forgetting the 19-game unbeaten run, but they were found wanting on a big occasion, as was Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. He seemed to be exposed, you know, admitted selection mistakes. Did that tell us a lot about Manchester United and how far they've got to go? And it does leave him with a huge decision over David De Gea, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I think it told us that squad depth isn't brilliant, certainly not as strong as a team like Chelsea's. Solskjaer has by and large performed well in the big games this season, so I wouldn't write him off as a tactician. He had a bit of a stinker, no doubt about it. He picked the wrong team. I said in the last pod that this would be priority number three for Manchester United, and his team selection bore that out. In my opinion, he changed the shape to fit in with the players that he was leaving out. It was like, well, I want to leave him and him out, which means I have to put these guys in. And you know what? I think that works better in a 3-4-1-2. So let's just roll with that. I don't think that it was the best team or formation for a cup semi-final. So in that sense, he had a very bad day at the office. But ultimately, all eyes are on top four and Europa League, in my opinion. So no, I think that was a slight anomaly, that performance. Well, let's call it right. It was a non-performance from Manchester United.
It was a bit of as an occasion, it was a non-event, wasn't it? In terms of, you know, if you're going to have a big stadium and empty, surely Wembley is probably the worst stadium you could have in lockdown. It just felt really wrong. Am I being a bit over-romantic?
No, I completely agree with you. I mean, what do you associate? My favourite times as a football writer have actually been, funnily enough, at Wembley in the sort of the 10, 15 minutes before a cup semi-final or final starts, when it's just the fans, before that ridiculously loud PA system kicks in and, and the Wembley announcer, bless him, you know, does what he does.
And tiresomely.
When you take that away, when you take away the flags and the anticipation, what you're left with is something very strange indeed. It's kind of why I had a really bizarre idea before football came back. I thought that they should have moved some of these games, these really high tier games, to strange places, like non-league grounds. And I understand the kind of the biological restrictions and, you know, why that probably wouldn't have worked. But it'd been great if you'd had like Chelsea Man United playing at Twerton Park or something, or, you know, something similar, or, you know, play a semi-final at Dulwich Hamlets Ground or at Kingstonian or something. Because I think it's it would have taken away some of the weirdness of it. It becomes very difficult to buy into the gravitas of an occasion when you can hear the echo of the ball and you can hear the player swearing. And I watched the League One playoff final a week ago. And
that was great. I really enjoyed that.
Really good game. But it's certainly strange when Oxford United equalised from that mishit cross and like nine of their players came running to the TV camera to swear down the lens. Like, that was just like, it's just very strange. And, you know, we have to be forgiving. But Wembley, you're right, Mike. Wembley just makes it that much stranger.
Yeah. Well, one thing that was decided in the EFL is promotion of Leeds to the Premier League. There will be an avalanche of comments, some informed, some hysterical, because of the nature of that club, but potentially. Marcelo Bielsa in the Premier League, you know, assuming he signs his new contract, that's going to be fun, isn't it, Aidan?
Oh, very much so, yeah. I do like watching Leeds United. He's an innovator as a coach, and he will make sure that Leeds are very awkward opponents for anyone in the top flight. They'll pose the kind of questions that very few teams do pose, just purely by their shape and movement and fitness. They are incredibly fit, Leeds United, under Bielsa. So no, I'm excited to see how they fare. They were sensational against Arsenal for 45 minutes in the FA Cup back in January. They couldn't keep it going, didn't score. And that has kind of been their failing. They've not scored enough goals, even though they've gone up as champions. And I do worry that in the top flight, that will be a bigger issue, of course. So for me, they definitely need to upgrade in the striker's position. And at the back, Ben White is on loan from Brighton. And based on the quality of his performances, Brighton would be daft not to bring him back into their team. So they need a centre half, probably a keeper, and a centre forward. But there is also that feeling that he might need to regenerate. I sense, because he doesn't like to make changes, that he'll be quite loyal, like Chris Wilder was at Sheffield United. I don't know if he's got every ounce of quality out of that particular team. I think they need four or five new starters, actually, but it will take time for those guys to be moulded into the Bielsa way, which might mean, actually, that they get off to a slow start next season.
It's important, isn't it, that the club doesn't get carried away. You know, you've got the chief exec already talking of them as a Champions League club in the near future. If you take Sheffield United as a good model, which I think it is, it's all about measured investment, isn't it? To a set strategy.
I think so. I think that's where Leeds are really interesting, Mike, in terms of what their strategy is likely to be. I don't think it's a secret that Andrea Redrazzani, the owner, enjoys a close friendship with Nasser Al-Khelaifi, the PSG chairman. And I think there's always been the suggestion that, or Redrazzani, who wants Leeds to be a power in the Premier League, but he also concedes that he's probably not the right person to make them that power, the right person to deliver them back into the league, but what happens afterwards. So it'd be really interesting to see whether, on their immediate re-entry, whether they do adopt that slightly Sheffield United sort of approach of, let's consolidate, let's do what we absolutely need to do. And then a year's time, when that stability exists, whether potentially a sale happens and then that next step occurs after that. I think that's what I'd expect. Bielsa's awkward for whatever else he is. His idiosyncrasies probably mean that if someone were to come in above him, or someone were to impose a kind of a phalanx of what we would call Premier League ready footballers and force them on his side, that's the kind of thing that would force him not to consider his future at the club, but that is not going to be healthy. So I would suspect that the team that takes the field in the Premier League in, you know, a month and a half's time is going to largely be what it was, you know, last weekend. Because otherwise, there's no way of ensuring Bielsa's future. There's no way of getting him to sign the contract, the new contract, and get him to commit his short-term future to the club, other than to allow him to continue with the kind of the creation of this project. Because that's what he likes to do. He's difficult and he's contrary. He's the kind of person that might say, oh, you know what, I kind of fancy, you know, going to manage Lille for, you know, a year and a half again. You know, that kind of thing. So you have to tread carefully with him.
I can imagine, maybe, let's say Philippe Coutinho, let's go back to him. I can imagine, like, Leeds ownership maybe thrusting Coutinho into Bielsa's dressing room saying, there you go, look,
he'd be disgusted.
There's a world-class
he'd be
player.
Disgusted.
And no, I'm telling you what would happen. He wouldn't pick him till January. he'd just leave him on the bench. Train him up and say he's not ready.
Or he'd walk out, you know, because
yes.
If you don't give Bielsa the right conditions, he does not react well, and he's not afraid just to walk out. He is a incredibly headstrong personality.
Football clubs, as we know, are strange, politically fragile places anyway, and you've only got to look at Watford for that, haven't you? Now, they're in disarray. They're looking for their 13th manager in 9 seasons. Nigel Pearson sacked. I thought it was extraordinary. You know, when he appointed, Watford had one victory. If you extrapolate his performances, that's worth about 45 points over a full season. I saw a stat somewhere that would, I think, be Watford's second best ever Premier League performance. You know, the owners got rid of 2 key players in January, gave him one back. To say that he was undervalued is to put it mildly, isn't it?
Well, yeah, from a footballing perspective, it seems like a bonkers decision. But football isn't just about football, is it? It's about personalities and it's about conflict sometimes. And there are strong rumours doing the rounds that there was a major disagreement inside the dressing room at West Ham. I'm not surprised because they didn't play well in that match, and that something's been reported back from one of Pozzo's members of staff to the top, and then there's been a strong discussion that has ended in this decision. That is just a rumour that I think I'm not the only person that's heard that. So sometimes it just comes down to two people having a blazing row and saying, you know, and the person in charge saying you're out. It can't have been anything else, because you wouldn't choose to ditch Pearson and bring in Hayden Mullins for the last two games of the season. You just wouldn't do it. That is footballing suicide, really, to leave a manager, to put a manager to one side that has galvanised the group. And for me, it found his best team of late, even though that was a poor performance at West Ham. So yeah, it's a worry for West Ham. It's a worry for Watford. They're just praying that Villa and Bournemouth don't get the results now.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, when you look at it, yeah, it was interesting that, you know, there are reports that Troy Deeney might get some form of almost player coach role in the short term. But let's look at the players, can we, Seb? Because of the nature of the football club, and it's a club which is completely wedded to its business plan, you know, a player doesn't have an emotional investment in the club because there's no emotional investment in them. Can you get that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the club is set up to almost be a facilitator of players' ambition. Watford pitch themselves as a club whereby players can come in, can achieve, and then bounce out to somewhere else. It's a very transient model. And you're right, Mike. I mean, it's also, I wonder if this is kind of the explanation for a lot of what we've seen from Watford in the past. In the first few years when they came back into the Premier League, they had that habit of just collapsing once safety was assured, and then seeing out the rest of the season until let's be honest, the new cast of players could be put together for the next year. What worries me in this instance is I was reading my friend Adam Leventhal's reporting on this situation, on the Pearson sacking. One of the details in there was that there was some animus stoked up by one of Nigel Pearson's team selections, the failure to include Nathaniel Chalabar in the West Ham game. Irritated members of the ownership or the executive structure. You know, we can debate the tactical element of that, and maybe there's a point, but the idea that you've got non-footballing people querying team selections, that's really worrying. Like, because you, if it's, I mean, I don't know, it was non-specific who was irritated by that, but if you've got a manager who you've appointed and you're second-guessing the team he puts on the pitch, I don't think any good footballing story includes that kind of anecdote. You know, you go anywhere back in history, you see sort of owners who think they know the game a little bit better than they really do, or, you know, technical directors, whatever the case may be. If you appoint a manager and you're willing to let it be known that you're not happy with his team selection, that's not on. Those are not the good conditions. They're the right conditions for a team to develop under any circumstances.
It feels to me like Pozzo, the owners there, the Pozzos, it's their club, and they don't want managers to stick around because they were then be synonymous with that club. It's their club, and they just want to bring in who they want when they want, and I think it's almost a power trip on their part. I really do. Going back to your other point though, they have had a number of players that have been stables, that have been constants. Foster, Deeney, Doucouré, Capoue, guys like that have been there for a while. It's evolving.
No, I agree there, mate. But isn't that sort of, I mean, not in every case, but isn't that because some of them just haven't been able to earn moves elsewhere? Mm-hmm. Like Doucouré mm-hmm. wanted to leave, but no one would pay the money that no one would pay his asking price. You know, I'm sure, you know, one of the ways in which Gerard Deulofeu was coached the club was, you know, you can relaunch your career. You can go back to the level from which you've fallen. And he can't because he's too inconsistent. He's injury prone. And so in some cases, I'm sure there is loyalty and people love being in the club. But I don't know, like it feels like that's an indictment of performance as much as anything else, possibly.
Watford at Manchester City on Tuesday and then at Arsenal. Now, Villa need to probably beat Arsenal on Tuesday to give themselves a chance, don't they, Aidan?
Not necessarily, because West Ham, who are safe on the last day of the season, all of a sudden that they look not inviting opponents, but they look beatable. So So no, I think a draw against Arsenal is certainly achievable. Look, they're at home, but their home record against the bigger teams has been dreadful, hasn't it, Aston Villa? So if they were to get a draw, I think they might see it as a victory of sorts and back themselves to go and win at the London Stadium. And then the ball is in Watford's court. Can they nick anything from their really challenging last couple of games? So, no, I wouldn't write Villa off at this stage. I think they can get points from both games.
What about Bournemouth, Seb? They're at Everton in their final game. They can't score, they can't defend, and VAR is ganging up on them by the look of it. Is that classic relegation material?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, goodness, how cruel was that? That VAR yeah. intervention. That's probably the cruelest of the season, given the way that, do you see the reaction of the goalkeeper and, you know, of Eddie Howe? And I don't know, that was tough. Yeah, Mike, also, I think I gave up on Bournemouth the moment we found out that Nathan Aké was going to miss the rest of the season. Can't defend. You know, that attacking, David Brooks has come back into the team and they look a little bit better for that, but he's not fully fit. He's not back where he was before he got hurt. And yeah, I think probably, had that equaliser stood, I'd have been able to make a case for them surviving. As it is, because of their goal difference, because they managed to concede an extra goal after that happened, Shea Adams made it 2-0. I think the hole is too deep now. And that saddens me. I know we always say this about clubs that are threatened by relegation, but there really are some very nice people at Bournemouth. From a journalist perspective, I've always been treated very well by the people that work there, and they've been very considerate and helpful. Those are the people that are going to get it in the neck, I'm afraid. So it's a very sad situation, but it looks inevitable now.
Okay, let's try and pull this all together then. Since you've got the mic, Seb, any thought for the day?
Yes, Mike. I wanted to have a rant about goalkeeping analysis. It's one of the blind spots in broadcast media when a goalkeeper is out of form. And yeah, we are talking about David De Gea here. It's amazing that even now, in 2020, years after kind of the dawn of the new television age, we still assess goalkeepers with generalities. We're talking about players. We're talking about players being disappointed with things, or maybe doing better, or no. The sort of the analysis of David De Gea's day at Wembley against Chelsea was pretty damning. But where's the discussion about the nature of goalkeeping form? Because it's an incredibly complicated beast, isn't it? It's not like being a forward and scoring a goal and, you know, and sort of returning to your equilibrium. It's a much more convoluted process. And so I really would like, it doesn't necessarily have to be ex-goalkeepers working in punditry, but it should be people that understand the position. And it's such an oddity. I mean, I'm biased because he's my friend and we know him and we like him. But, you know, where's the place for someone like Dave Preece, in this kind of thing? Because, you know, when you follow analysis of the position on Twitter, for instance, and Dave isn't the only person that does this, it's fascinating for people like me that sort of, you know, you don't kind of have access to that kind of knowledge, and goalkeeping training and, you know, in coaching sessions is sort of almost occurs in a little cave of its own where no one else is, you know, able to sort of watch or learn anything about it. So let's do better on that front. Let's have some guys that really know what they're talking about actually diagnose the problems with someone like David De Gea when they appear, or, you know, maybe have that, you know, we were talking about the Leno Martinez conundrum at Arsenal. Let's have people that can actually add some weight to that. Get them in the, you know, in the studios, and let's hear what they have to say, because I'd be interested. I want to know how did David De Gea go from being one of the best goalkeepers I've ever seen to what he is now, with all due respect, you know. I want to know more about that. So let's do better.
Matt Murray's good as well.
Actually, that's very fair. Matt Murray is very good.
He is on the books at Sky, and yeah, I think they should use him more in that capacity potentially. Yeah, I'll stick with the goalkeeper theme then, if I may. Does having no crowds impact on a goalkeeper's performance? I'm just thinking about the playoff finals that we saw at Wembley, Leagues 2, League 1, goalkeepers just basically had a nightmare. David De Gea yesterday had a stinker. We've seen it in the Premier League, goalkeepers being caught in possession. Alisson against Arsenal recently, prior to that, Southampton's keeper was sloppy. I just feel that the presence of fans might just sharpen up the majority of goalkeepers. It's just a little thing to throw out there, but it strikes me that unexpectedly, because you would imagine with 10,000 people standing behind you, potentially screaming abuse at you, you would think that would be a tougher environment for a goalkeeper. It's not working out like that. Strange.
Yeah. Well, I hope you forgive me this Victor Meldrew moment, but celebrity referees? Really? That should be a contradiction in terms, since the most effective officials tend to be efficient rather than effervescent, or think they're effervescent. Now, I'll come clean. I've had an aversion to personality refs ever since someone called Roger Milford, who was a permed, preening ninny, unnecessarily sent off Wilf Rostrum, one of my favourite Watford players at the time, and cost him the chance to captain a team in the 1984 FA Cup final. Football fans never forgive and certainly never forget. You could argue that the personalised boots worn by John Moss in Saturday's semi-final were subtle. Yet the word mossy embroidered into the leather. Dear me.
Come on, Mike.
What next? The Mike Reed autographed red card? You'd have thought in this era of recurring chaos triggered by VAR that referees need to keep a low profile. What do you think? I'll be interested in your views. And thanks once again for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.